Tuesday. Following James in Tahoma. Stick around and tell us on the table. Well, he fell in love with a Gun Street girl.
Brian, I have a question for you.
Do you ever not?
Okay, stop. Stop being so sassy. All right. If someone told you that at its peak, the absolute statistical King's Peak, that more than 4 in 10 people in Utah were living inside a polygamous family, what would you say?
I'm no big city maths guy, but I would say that's a lot of sister wives.
I believe the math is 43.6%. That's not a fringe practice Mormon apologists would have you believe. That's the 1860 federal census.
Wait, that's not 2 or 3%. That's like half the population.
Yeah, like nearly half. And then within 30 years, it allegedly collapses to 7%. So today we're asking, what happened in the 1860s? What made this decade the absolute apex of Mormon plural marriage? And what did it actually cost the people who lived it?
These are real people, real stories in the swinging 60s. Shag carpets, burning your draft card, digging on the doors, getting ready for a road trip up to Yasgur's farm.
Wrong 60s. Rewind the clock about 100 years. But despite that, there were real stories and they're messier than any mom talk drama, I can tell you that.
Was there a dance?
There's at least a dance.
That's good.
There's a bunch of murder, too. Some of them are hard. Today, we're doing a deep dive into one of the most contested, most misunderstood chapters in Latter-day Saint history, polygamy at its height, the 1860s, the decade when plural marriage was not underground, not whispered about, not lied about, not forged in Clayton's diaries. It was practiced openly, defended publicly, and woven into the theological, economic, and social fabric of an entire territory. And before you think I started a Richard Dutcher rumor, Clayton's diaries are not forged. Continue.
All right, we're going to cover a lot of ground today. There's going to be some statistics, which is actually a good thing, because instead of vibe claims and saying, I feel like this, these are hard data here. And the theology that makes this feel not just permissible, but sacred, and then the federal government's attempts to crush it, of course they would. What it looked like at the very top, like in Brigham Young's family, and then what it looked like for average yahoos who are just trying to live their faith and feed their kids. Let's go.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
So before we get into the stories, we need to paint the picture. It's 1860, Utah Territory. What is this place?
Well, it's a territory. It's not a state yet.
Nope, not a state. It won't be a state for a hot second, and polygamy is a big reason why. In 1860, the Transcontinental Railroad hasn't been built just yet. Salt Lake City is still genuinely really remote. You have to cross plains or mountains to get there, and people are still doing it. In fact, the very last of the Mormon handcart pioneers arrives in Salt Lake City on September 24th, 1860. And these are people who had pulled their worldly possessions across the continent into wooden handcarts. They arrived that fall. And
wait. The Willie and Martin weren't like the only handcart companies ever. There were other ones.
They had multiple ones. Some fared better than others, but all of it sucked. That's the headline. And in fact, Brian, I don't know if you know this, they're still doing handcart companies today.
Well, how are we going to get all those flour sack babies across the plains?
Just got to kill a chicken if you're 14, that's all. Okay, yeah, so the handcart company, the last of it arrives that fall, and the community that they're coming into, it's a community that's full flush practicing the principle. They just survived the Mormon Reformation and a near all-out war within the federal government.
I hope all these people have been adequately informed about this with informed consent. Spoiler alert. In 1860, the percentage of the population living inside polygamous households reaches the all-time high that we mentioned, 43.6%. And that's from federal census data, corroborated by historians like Ben Binion, who mapped polygamy rates community by community across Utah. This is not like a small sect within the church or something.
No, you have to understand the scale, because growing up, we were often told that it was such a small percentage of people that actually practiced it.
But not on national television did we ever say things like that.
No.
To folks like, I don't know, Larry King, let's live, just pull a name in, yeah.
No. It was barely anyone did it. But in the 1860s, it's almost the majority experience or close to it. And yet, this is also important to remember. It's not universal. So there were always more monogamous Mormon households than polygamous ones. People didn't like this. I don't know if you know this, but it wasn't very popular. The men who actually practiced it were a minority. Think about the math about that. Of course, the men were the minority. There were more women.
And you can't fight City Hall and you can't fight gender ratios.
And you don't want to fight Jedediah Grant. It was mostly relegated to leadership, but the culture of it, the theology of it, the way that it organized social life and determined status, that touched everyone and arguably still does today, aka Carolyn Pearson, Ghost of Eternal Polygamy. Check it out if you don't believe that polygamy still haunts the LDS church today.
And so even if you're not living in a plural marriage, you're living in a society built around the idea that plural marriage is the highest form of family and godliness. You will have friends, you will have relatives, it's all around you.
Exactly. Historian Davis Benton has written about how polygamy scholarship for a long time got stuck arguing about whether it was harmful or beneficial, rather than asking the better, more important question, what was it actually like? What did it mean to the people who lived it? And why did they do it? And when you actually go to the sources, the diaries, the letters, the later oral histories, the answers are more complicated than either the critics or the defenders want to admit.
And this is the decade where all of that gets very visible. One more thing before we get into the theology. 1860 is also the year that a very famous outside observer comes to take a look. Richard Francis Burton. He's a British explorer. He's an adventurer. This guy snuck into Mecca disguised as a Muslim pilgrim. He's the first European to enter the forbidden city of Harar in Somaliland. He's the co-white discoverer of Lake Tanganyika in Africa. And then he decides to visit Utah, of all places.
So think of him as an early, like, Hulu exec that knows that Utah and its messiness would make a really good Hulu true crime documentary. If he were alive today, he'd be a producer making a docuseries on the crazy polygamous Mormons. He arrives in Salt Lake City in August of 1860. He spends 3 weeks here. He meets Brigham Young, meets Porter Rockwell, studies the whole operation with the eyes of a man who has spent his career going places no Westerner was supposed to go. And the next year, he publishes The City of the Saints and Across the Rocky Mountains to California.
So why Utah? Remember, this is a guy who's been to Mecca in Africa. How does Salt Lake City make the list? Burton himself said he was a collector of holy cities. Mecca, Harar, and Salt Lake City were the three. And, not surprisingly, he's specifically drawn by polygamy. Remember, his other work has him crashing Egyptian harems. He studied sexual customs across the Middle East and Africa. You might see him as arguably the Victorian era's most notable scholar of comparative marriage practices. So when he arrives in the American West and finds a Christian community openly practicing plural marriage, he's riveted. He describes it as placing Utah squarely in a global tradition. His argument essentially was that 4/5 of the world's population practiced polygamy, that Western monogamy is the historical outlier. He is deliberately trying to desensationalize the Mormons at a moment when the Eastern press is treating them like a freak show. And then he gets an audience with Brigham Young.
Yeah, he gets an audience with Brigham Young, and the description he leaves us is one of the most interesting portraits of Young we have from any outside observer. Burton arrives expecting, based on the lurid anti-Mormon press, some kind of wild-eyed prophet, And what he finds is a heavyset man in a gray homespun who speaks with directness and occasional humor. Burton writes that his first impression was that Young was, quote, no common man, and that he showed, quote, none of the weakness and vanity which characterized the common, uncommon man.
That's a lot of words to just say he had game, right?
Stop it. He also noted a total absence of pretension. I would question that. A somewhat bloodless manner. All right, I'm on
That's
board.
What Rockwell's for.
And above all, a sense of power so settled it required no performance. He describes Young's gifts as indomitable will, profound secrecy, and uncommon astuteness. I'll drink to that. That's Burton's clinical eye. He's not describing a fanatic. He's describing a CEO. But my fave line is profound secrecy.
Did he mean profound sacredcy? Maybe, I mean, that's probably how the British spell it.
Sure, that's the British spelling.
It's like the U in color, I'm guessing. Crucially, Young took Burton on a personal tour of Salt Lake City. He shows him his private school for his children. He showed him the Lion House where his wives lived. If you remember the Morris Young episode, he probably showed him all the cool roller skates on the balcony. So much fun. Young, for his part, clearly saw Richard Burton as someone who might be useful. This celebrated outsider who could give the Saints a fair hearing before a European and an American reading audience. And for the most part, Burton obliged, though not without his characteristic dry wit. For example, his description of the Book of Mormon is one of the most famous things he ever wrote about Mormonism. He said it, quote, emulates the sprightliness of Leviticus. That is not a compliment.
No. It's not, but I love it. Here's where it gets really interesting for our episode. Burton goes to Salt Lake City specifically to study polygamy, and what he observes confounds almost every expectation the outside world had brought to the subject. The anti-Mormon press, remember, had built up this image of Mormon harems, of women kept locked away, veiled, and degraded, living in some Orientalist fantasy of captivity. And they actually, as historians have pointed out, compare Mormons to Orientalism at the time, as if it was its own race. And Burton goes, look, and people ask, like, was it human trafficking? This is the word that they would have used. Orientalism was associated with human trafficking at the time. They didn't use the word human trafficking. That's what they thought. And so Mormonism being called that is that allegation. But Burton goes looking for this harem and finds something far more boring. He tours the Lion House. He looks for mystery and locked doors and suffering women. And instead, he finds women going about their daily business, making pies in the basement. His famous line is devastating in its understated irony. Mormon polygamy was perhaps simply, quote, the monotony of monogamy multiplied.
Yeah, that's a pretty decent line.
I've said it on Year of Polygamy, and I didn't realize Burton had said it too. Like, I was just ripping off Burton somehow. But Mormon polygamy isn't true polygyny. It's multiple monogamies.
And it captures something real about what the outside world couldn't really process, that the actual practice of Mormon polygamy is so much duller than that fantasy people had. Women everywhere, he said. What was missing was the mystery, the exoticness, because he describes the women he meets as modest and quiet and subdued and sick of the wind and the dust, and he finds them, in his own words, quote, exceedingly pretty and attractive. He explicitly pushes back on the anti-Mormon image of ugly, degraded, plural wives. Other British observers...
Wait, do you hear that, you guys? Your grandmas were hot. They were hot stuff.
There's got to be a great, some British phrase that he used there.
They didn't even have Jesse's hair extensions to help them out or their white teeth. They were just hot. Sweet spirits, as they say.
So some earlier observers had described these women as plain and melancholic, and that wouldn't you have melancholy after being the seventh wife living alone somewhere? I mean, that's not unfair. Others, as healthy and contented looking. Burton keeps insisting that the wretchedness had been greatly exaggerated. He does write, pointedly, that, quote, human nature is apt to suit itself to necessities, and many among their daily occupations have little time for repining. Exactly. Which, it's a cold comfort, honestly, but it's what he saw. And we should note that Burton actually had limited access to the women's actual inner lives.
Limited is generous. How about none? He was a 19th century gentleman traveling with letters of introduction, and he spent most of his time with men. He admits this himself. He writes that, quote, any woman could learn in 1 hour more about polygamy in either Salt Lake City or in Islam than a man could learn in a year. So he knows the limits of his own evidence, which he can observe in the social architecture of what he sees. And what he sees is a community that's built in an entire civilization around this principle. He attends a church conference, he visits a historian's office, and he reads everything that they'll give him. He goes to the endowment house looking for evidence of, and I'm quoting the anti-Mormon press here, quote, human sacrifices or orgies, and finds a very boring building. The whole project.
This endowment house, I think, is really interesting because this human sacrifice thing of like throwing the bodies in the trap door, like this was a common thing. I think some people truly thought that was real.
Well, like Anne Gorge, who was married to John D. Lee, when she goes on to write her autobiography, which they think she was trying to turn into a dime novel, she makes this allegation, right, that she sees Heber Kimball, Porter Rockwell, there's a trapdoor in the bottom of the endowment house. I mean, would I still like an archaeological dig under there? Sure. Would I absolutely welcome that? But it does remind me, like in modern day, we have we know sexual abuse rates are ubiquitous in Mormonism. LDS communities have a huge problem with this, but sometimes, and the ritual abuse does exist within the communities. We do have evidence of that, but there are these stories of like altars and baby hearts in the temple. And it's kind of the similar thing. It's like stories that ritual stuff happens. And I've been thinking a lot about that too. Like, just like we have rogue, crazy Lafferty types now, you had them back then too. So there was probably all kinds of crazy ritual stuff going on as well. Anyway, the whole project of his book, Burton's book, is puncturing one sensationalist myth after another with his careful observation. And I wish more people would understand this about oppressive systems. Some of the hardest parts of living it, like living polygamy, isn't some sort of Bosch painting with creatures devouring humans or like musical instruments repurposed as torture devices. It's the painstaking, perpetual, never relenting boredom.
And that goes back. Paul Bailey wrote a book called Polygamy Was Better Than Monotony, which is one of the great titles of all time. So the theocracy in Mormonism, what does Mr. Burton make of Brigham Young's actual political control? He is on the one hand impressed, but also alarmed by it. In a detached Burton way, he describes the political system with brilliant sarcasm. He calls it the perfection of government because it combines, quote, the universal suffrage of the American states tempered by the despotism of France and Russia. Every church officer was first chosen of the Lord through his prophet and then voted in by every adult male at conference. So the Mormon man, Burton notes with acid precision, had, quote, all the harmless pleasure of voting without the danger of injuring himself by his vote. You could probably describe a lot of institutions like that.
It really could. I love him, his writing so much. So other British visitors made a similar point. William Dixon, who visited a few years later, said that T.B.H. Stenhouse, who was the prominent English convert who served as a kind of unofficial liaison to visiting dignitaries, guiding everyone from Burton to Dixon through Salt Lake, told him that Brigham Young, quote, ought to do everything and have his way in everything. And Dixon was horrified. He called it Asiatic obedience to a man without birth. Again, we get that Oriental, which was this specific kind of racism applies to people from Asia. And Mormons weirdly get lumped into that. Now, Stenhouse later left the church and his wife, Fanny, wrote one of the most important apostate narratives of this era. We need to do an episode about them. But in the 1860s, he was a true believer, escorting every important visitor through Salt Lake. And what he was showing those visitors was a community that was, by most external measures, genuinely prospering. Wide streets, irrigation ditches, houses surrounded by fruit trees and English flowers, dances and taffy pulling. And Burton notes the absence of bars and brothels. Successive British visitors record industry, sobriety, order, cleanliness, tranquility. The saints were building something impressive.
And I think the fact that it really is still kind of in the middle of nowhere also impressed them. Like, they're not connected to stuff yet. Again, no railroad, not quite telegraph. Like, they're building their own thing in the desert. And all of that makes the polygamy harder to dismiss. Of course, Burton understood that. His larger argument was that Mormons were not alien to Western civilization, but that they're a logical outgrowth of Protestantism. Their claim to biblical sanction for polygamy, he argues, is as theologically defensible as any other scriptural argument in Christianity. And Orson Pratt is standing behind him saying, yes, thank you, I agree. He's not endorsing it exactly, but he's pointing out that condemning it required condemning the same hermeneutic moves that every other Protestant sect had made. The critics' outrage, in Burton's view, told you more about them than it did about the Mormons. He said as much directly. The issue had been used, quote, by designing men to raise up enmity against a peaceful, industrious, and a law-abiding people. So Burton becomes, weirdly, one of the best defenses of the Mormon community in the 1860s.
Weirdly, yes. And the Mormons largely rejected the book anyway, partly because Burton's irony cut too close to the bone, partly because he was obviously not a believer, and partly because, as Samuel Taylor once wrote, quote, "The last thing the Mormons have ever wanted is a mirror." But why? Their women are so hot. I don't get it. But historians have returned to it ever since because Burton was doing something genuinely rare. He was treating this community as a subject worthy of serious analysis at a moment when almost everything else was either attacking it or defending it. He walked into Salt Lake City in 1860 at the absolute peak of plural marriage, and he tried genuinely to see it clearly. And what he saw was a community under enormous external pressure, holding together through faith and institutional discipline, led by a man of extraordinary will, and practicing something that was, in Burton's global view, far less exotic than Americans wanted to believe.
So let's talk about the theology of polygamy, because I think this is where a lot of people, even maybe especially people who grew up Mormon, have gaps there. Because if you don't understand why these people believe this is sacred, then you can't understand why they endured what they endured. You can't understand the sacrifice or the coercion or the genuine devotion without the theological architecture underneath it.
So let's do a recap in case you're just tuning in and haven't listened to the past 150 episodes. So Joseph Smith, Mormonism's founder, receives what becomes Doctrine and Covenants, Section 132, the Revelation on Celestial Marriage, which is recorded in 1843, though some of his close associates say the practice begins earlier. And the core idea is this: marriage to be eternal has to be sealed by the proper priesthood authority, and for the highest degree of celestial glory, the fullness of exaltation, a man needs to be sealed to plural wives. So this isn't just about having a family or multiple wives. This is about becoming, as Mormon theology puts it, co-creators with God. The more righteous posterity you raise up unto the Lord, the greater your eternal kingdom.
And Mormons of this time saw this as a literal building of the kingdom, and including their own kingdom. The women who enter these marriages, when you look at their own voices, their journals, their testimonies, many of them are not just passive. Historian Julie Dunphy has done really important work here, going back to the primary sources of women who actually wrote about their experiences in the 1860s and 1870s. What she finds is that many of these women, not all, but many, frame their entry into plural marriage in deeply spiritual terms. They talk about submitting to God's will, about eternal blessings, about proving their faith.
The women who used their own words in real time often described a genuine spiritual conviction that this was what God required of them. The historical record shows that both husbands and wives, when asked why they entered these relationships, emphasized the spiritual blessings of being sealed eternally and of obeying God. Men also benefited materially and socially in ways that women, surprise, surprise, often didn't. A man with many wives had more labor in his household, more children, more land under cultivation, more social status in the community, and the spiritual motivations were also real, and the material benefits were also real, and sometimes it's impossible to fully separate them.
So faith and patriarchy are doing a lot of work at the same time. And don't get confused that because it was part of the theology that everybody just accepts it blindly. There's enormous social pressure. Your bishop might counsel you into it. The scriptures that you're reading will counsel you into this. Your husband might come home and tell you he'd been asked to take another wife. Women that refuse or protest are sometimes told they are impeding their husband's exaltation. There are cases of women being told that their resistance was a spiritual failing. And then there were women who sincerely didn't want it. They said so loudly and they left. We'll talk about some of them. And then, sorry, I was just going to say one more thing too, is the importance of the sacrifice narrative that Mormonism has always quite loved. They all know it's hard. The way to frame that is, well, obviously, if it's super hard, it's because it's that important. It gives you that many blessings if it's that difficult.
And this is like skipping ahead, but when, you know, the LDS Church abandons it, they have a huge vacuum to fill theologically. And so I argue that they fill it with shame about LGBT stuff and about pornography. And think about it. That fills the vacuum of shame. If you're a woman and you're worried every day that your husband might come home from a meeting with, you know, some declaration that he's got to marry your neighbor girl, that anxiety causes a cultural phenomenon in women. And now it's just like, it's the same thing. Women are so scared that their husbands are looking at porn or that their kids are going to be gay or whatever. It's that same kind of anxiety that's being exploited here. Okay, so while all of this is happening inside Utah territory, the theological high watermark, the community building, the celestial marriages, the federal government is not sitting still either. So 1862 is the year that it all starts to bite. The Moral Anti-Bigamy Act passes in July of 1862. It's the first federal legislation targeting Mormon polygamy specifically. It makes bigamy in the territories a federal crime, punishable by a fine of up to $500 and up to 5 years in prison, and it also limits the amount of property the church can hold in any territory up to $50,000. And that's a direct shot at the institutional church. But does it work?
Nope, not yet. And to be honest, it doesn't seem like it was ever really designed to do it. I think you could argue the Moral Act was intended to stop polygamy the same way that Wilford Woodruff's manifesto was intended to stop it. There is no money allocated to enforcing this. There's no indication that Lincoln really ever meant to. Now, again, we're going to talk about there's a couple other things going on at the time, but what's interesting is it seems like Lincoln had enough people bugging him to do something that he could do this. I mean, this is a classic political move. You put something on the books and then you can say, oh no, look, see, I did something. This is where we get the maybe apocryphal story of Lincoln saying he deals with Mormons the way they would deal with stumps in the field when he was a kid. They were too wet to burn. They were too big to pull out. And so they just plowed around them. And even if he didn't tell that exact story, in practice, it seems like the Moral Act was that. There was just nothing that was going to happen. And of course, the big reason likely that that plays out that way is because a little distraction, a little tiff between brothers. We call it the Civil War. Not sure if anybody's ever heard of it. The Union's not going to send federal marshals into Utah to arrest these polygamists when they're fighting for survival in Virginia and Georgia. And so Mormons look at the Moral Act and basically say, we don't see this as constitutional. You're not going to enforce it. They're definitely right on the second point, at least for now. And so the 1860s are a window where the law exists on paper, sure, but the practice continues. And everybody back in Washington is way too busy to care.
Yeah, we're going to talk about this later, but the Civil War does change the structure of the federal army and military in general. So you don't have, you know, they tried to send troops out a few years earlier. That didn't go well. Now they're busy. You don't have overland travel like we talked about in our Pony Express. They are isolated. You want to know why the 1860s? This is why. It's hard to get to and there's not enough resources. So in a sense, the 1860s are the last decade of open practice without serious legal consequences. And the hammer comes later with the Poland Act in 1874 and then the Edmonds Act in 1882 and the Edmonds-Tucker Act in 1887. And these are the ones that actually start sending men to prison and disenfranchising women. And of course, they had the railroad by this time, so it's faster to get out there. But in the 1860s, the church is operating as if the principle is going to outlast the government's will to fight it. Brigham Young is essentially daring the federal government to come after him, which takes a certain amount of nerve or faith, depending on how you look at it.
If you look at some of the rhetoric of the sermons during the Civil War, it's pretty nuts. It's seen as pretty clearly as God's revenge on the nation, and they're going to come through just fine. It's pretty bananas rhetoric. It's also worth noting that in 1860, George Buchanan is ordained an apostle. He becomes one of the most important political and theological defenders of the practice in coming decades. He will famously be later prosecuted under the Edmonds Act, but in 1860, he's ascending. The institution is ascending. Everything feels to the saints like it's working out pretty great.
Okay. Okay, we can't talk about polygamy in the 1860s without talking about the man at the center of it all, Brigham Young. First, the question everyone asks, how many wives? And that answer would have scandalized Burton had he known the full scope of it. It was 55. That's the number most historians settle on, though the record is complicated because some sealings were time and eternity, marriages to women who had been sealed to Joseph Smith first, and some were for eternity and some for time, and the number of women he actually lived with and supported is closer to, but the scale is extraordinary by any measure. Historian Jill Mulvey Durr has written carefully about Brigham Young's world and the women in it, and what she makes clear is that you cannot understand the institution of plural marriage in Utah without understanding how Brigham himself practiced it and modeled it.
Because he's not just practicing it privately, he's the prophet. He's the example. His family is kind of the model. And this is interesting because later on in FLDS times, people will see a slightly grosser version of this with Warren Jeff's family. And in an era where we're starting to see more of his children and former wives speaking out, we get a better sense of what it actually looked like. Obviously, it's quite different. But it's interesting how, of course, and understandably, the leader's family is upheld as the model of how things should work. In the AUB case, there were people who very explicitly looked to how Rulon Allred's wives interacted and thought, okay, that's it. That's the model. That's how this principle should work.
Yeah, talking to Roy Jeffs, who is Warren Jeffs' son, he says, and people in the community will tell you, like the FLDS, the prairie dresses, the white cars, the God Squad, all that stuff was not like a formalized doctrine. Warren Jeffs instituted it in his family first. He started making his wives dress more conservatively. Their hair started changing. Their hair bumps got higher. And all of a sudden, it sets a standard. All of a sudden, his family and top church leaders are driving white cars. And that gets associated with righteousness. They don't even have to do anything. They just have to live it. And more people start to live it. That's sort of this primal tribal primate behavior in us where you want to follow the alpha in the community. And so you have to remember, Brigham Young knows this. And there's a reason why he's taking his family out to big events and stuff. He's modeling this for other people. He's the example. He's the administrator. He's the enforcer. He presides over the marriages of other men and he counsels women into marriages. He has enormous influence over who married whom, particularly among the leadership class. And his own household was by any measure a city unto itself. It really was. The Lion House in Salt Lake City, which you can still visit today, was built specifically to house some of his wives and children. Multiple stories, dozens of rooms, a communal dining room, a seamstress, a schoolroom. Okay, that's Brigham, but what was it actually like for the women?
That question depends a lot on which wife you were when you joined the household. So his first wife, Marian Angel, had been with him since the Nauvoo period. She was, by many counts, a capable, strong woman. She managed this enormous domestic operation. But as the household grows, and geez, does it grow through the 50s and 60s, the strains become real. There's competition for resources, for attention, for status, and for access to Brigham himself.
Gross. Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to judge why the secret lives of Mormon wives always have trouble with shitty men, look to their good example, their beloved pioneer prophet.
Access to Brigham himself is very important to these women. By many accounts, it's not usually a tender marriage, the bonding and uniting of two souls. This access isn't usually emotional, but more practical, because he controls the finances. The women of his household are not independently wealthy. They depend on his goodwill and allocation of resources. We see this with some of the wives who later left him. Annalisa Young, who becomes famous as wife number 19. You and I talked about her way back in the Year of Polygamy days. There's this great story where she is attempting to support herself with a boarding house. She would like a decent stove to cook for these people. Brigham won't buy her the damn stove. Simple things like this. She divorces him. She goes on a national lecture tour denouncing polygamy, files for divorce in 1873. But even back here in the 1860s, there's women in the household who are isolated, who are struggling financially and otherwise. They are not receiving what they felt like they were promised. There's virtually nothing they can do about it legally.
almost nothing. Historian Carol Cornwall Mattson has done essential work on the legal position of plural wives in Utah. And what she documents is a system where plural wives had essentially no legal standing, which, you know, a lot of women in that time period did not. They could not inherit as legal wives could, which is the difference. And it's still an issue today for plural wives. In most cases, they can't testify about their own marriages in court because plural marriage wasn't legally recognized. So they couldn't sue for divorce in the way a legal wife could. So a woman who entered plural marriage in good faith, who had children, who had built a life, if her husband stopped supporting her, she had very limited legal recourse. And you'll hear people argue like, no, every man, the man loved all the wives equally. The power was the same. I mean, here it's absolutely not. And it still is this way. The first wife, the legal wife, has more power, full stop. She has actual hard power.
So all of this entails a lot of profound, tragic vulnerabilities for these women. It's built into the structure by design in the sense that the church doesn't want the state adjudicating celestial marriage. They can't. These aren't legal marriages. But the effect is that it leaves women almost entirely dependent on either their husband's goodwill or the church's intervention. And church intervention, if it does come, is also subject to the judgment of men. So at the top, even, and especially in Brigham's own household, there are women who are suffering in ways that have really no institutional remedy.
Yes, and I think it's important to say this clearly. The scale of Brigham Young's household was not just a personal matter. It's a theological statement. It's a political statement, and it sets a template. It's an aspirational template, if you will, for every man in Utah who was thinking about entering the principle. He's saying, this is what power looks like, right? This is what righteousness looks like. So when you're trying to understand why 43.6% of the population is in a polygamous family, part of the answer is that the prophet himself has 55 wives and he's running the territory.
So one important statistical detail we glossed over, of polygamous men, 70% had only two wives, 20% had three, and just 10% had four or more. So the popular image of a lot of dudes with these huge, vast harems, zillions of wives, is definitely not the statistical reality. Most polygamous men, as the numbers show, had just one additional wife. The Brigham Young scale is genuinely extraordinary, not representative. You know, you have him, you have Heber Kimball, you have a very small handful of dudes who have that many wives. Those are special. And so that reframes the class dynamic segment significantly.
Benton also notes something important about why polygamy persisted in peaks and valleys. Quote, "It always took some form of pressure to stir them to renewed zeal. Left alone, they were prone to neglect it." In other words, it sucked to do and they needed pressure to do it. That's historian Stanley Ivan's findings cited by Bitten. And the implication is striking that polygamy wasn't naturally self-sustaining, even amongst believers. It required constant institutional pressure to maintain.
We've been talking a lot about Brigham Young and the leadership class, but polygamy, obviously, didn't only happen just at the top.
No, and this is where the demographic work gets really interesting, because historian Ben Bennion mapped polygamy rates across Utah communities, and what he found complicates the simple narrative that polygamy was only for the wealthy leaders. There were absolutely prosperous men with large plural households, like bishops, apostles, businessmen, who had the resources to support the multiple wives and many children. But there were also ordinary farmers, craftsmen, laborers who took plural wives with far fewer resources, which presumably made things even harder.
Much harder. When a guy who doesn't have a lot of money to begin with takes a second or a third wife, the math is brutal. The salary, the money coming in, remains the same, but there are more mouths to feed, more children being born, the same plot of land. The math just is very difficult. Jesse Embry's oral history work on plural families, when she is interviewing descendants in the 20th century about what their grandparents and great-grandparents had told them, is chock full of accounts of genuine material hardship. Wives are frequently living in separate small homes, sometimes barely habitable. Children are going without adequate food or clothing sometimes. These women are essentially running independent households with minimal support from a husband who might visit once a week or far less. Sometimes it's 6 months, a year in between visits, and little to no financial support in between the visits.
And tell us, Brian, did the church support and sustain the mess they demanded of their own?
Always. Wait, sorry, I didn't mean always. I meant sometimes. Tithing resources are occasionally redirected to struggling plural families, but that's largely if you are it's well known. If it's become known, maybe. Most people don't really want to say that because it's kind of embarrassing to say. And the bishops have some discretionary authority to assist, but the primary welfare system is these women, their extended family, and the community. So neighboring wives helping each other, older children will take on adult responsibilities, and what all of these oral histories that Jesse Embry has documented show is that in many cases, the first wife is actually the most economically vulnerable, kind of the reverse of what you might think, because later wives are younger, they have more energy. The first wife is older, her claim on the husband's time and resources was diminished. This trope of the favorite hot young sexy wife, the reason that trope exists is because it was often true. And the first wife often has no say.
Well, she technically had a right to be consulted, if we're being technical. Doctrine and Covenants, section 132, actually requires the first wife's consent, called the Law of Sarah. Ever heard of it?
Yeah, there's songs called, like, A Perfect Sarah, as our friend Christina loves to say.
Yeah, the fundamentalists do know this term a lot better than the LDS. There's a provision in the Revelation for it, though, and in practice, that consent was interpreted, I would say, very broadly, and there are unfortunately, abundant accounts of women being told that if they didn't give their consent, they were in spiritual peril. Often men showing up being like, hey, I've already married the other wife, and by the way, you have to consent. So this consent was operating under enormous coercive pressure. I don't know, why do Mormons have so much problems with sexual abuse rates? I don't understand. Yeah, in case you're wondering, that's not consent. Coercion is not consent, and the context is real. And while life on the frontier was hard for many women of any faith or culture, here it often compounds the issues. There's a reason why polygamy was equated with prostitution in the public view. The women who resisted, who said no clearly and meant it, some of them found that their resistance was used against them. There are accounts of women being told that their husbands would be given a younger, more faithful wife, and she would lose her place in the eternal family if she didn't comply. And that's a profound form of spiritual coercion, and sometimes women lost their physical property too.
An interesting book that's just about to come out from friends of the podcast, Jenny Lund and Beth Anderson, is this fantastic collection of missionary letters between Sainte Peterson and her husband, Anthon Lund. He's off in Europe several times on missions, and the early letters, Sainte will kind of joke about, oh, I'm sure you're going to bring home a wife, and it's kind of jokey, except that it isn't, and I think joking about it was her way of coping, because she knew that if he decided he wanted a wife, she really couldn't say boo, practically speaking.
And that's kind of like the pick me girl trope, right? You had to be cool about it. Like the cool wives were cool about it.
Oh, look at me. I would be so cool with a sister wife. You wouldn't even know how cool I'd be. Yeah. Yeah. There are different ways to deal with it. Joking a lot of times is better than others. Now, having said that, like we mentioned earlier, some women seem to genuinely embrace this.
Yeah, both things are true, and that's what makes the historical record so rich and so uncomfortable. The same institution that produced genuine spiritual community and deep female friendships with plural wives who are genuinely close, who supported each other through childbirth and illness and grief, also produced situations of profound isolation and coercion and depression. It's not uniform. It was a human institution administered by humans for power, which means it ran the full range of human behavior. Okay, we promised you real stories, so we're gonna give you the holy number to get you into the celestial kingdom 3.
All right, why don't you tell us about Mary Eddy?
Okay, Mary Eddy V. Smith is one of the most important and underappreciated voices in the history of Mormon polygamy. So she enters plural marriage in the 1850s, and by the early 1860s, she has left the church entirely and was publicly speaking about her experience. And she later published an account called 15 Years Among the Mormons, which becomes part of the wave of apostate narratives that fueled Eastern antipathy toward Utah.
So she's not a hostile witness.
She's a traumatized one. And historians sometimes ignore her for that reason.
Well, apostate narratives have their own polemical agenda, Lindsay.
I have weird feelings about calling it a polemical agenda when telling her story of what she went through is considered an agenda, when Burton can come through and write about whatever he wants and make money off other people's stories, and we don't say boo about that. And modern day women that like escape Warren Jeffs, we believe their stories. We're not like, what's their agenda?
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, every story has an agenda. Like, you can't really escape that. But the details that she gives us about the daily texture of plural family life, the economic precarity, the emotional isolation, those all match closely enough with other sources that you can't just dismiss her. What her account captures is the experience of a woman who entered plural marriage with genuine faith and found that the reality of it bore almost no resemblance to the promise. This promised sisterhood, the spiritual elevation, the eternal sealing, that all became defenses for it. She found instead competition, neglect, a community that had no mechanism for her grievance. And when she left everything. Her community, her eternal family, her children's future in the covenant. These are not small things to just walk away from.
And yet she did, and she spent the rest of her public life trying to tell people what she had seen. Whatever we think about the politics or her polemics, that's a life shaped entirely by what plural marriage cost her. And I've heard people dismiss, like, well, she just did it to make money. What else was she going to do, like, for money? Come on.
All right, what's our second story?
Okay, next up, we got the Richardson family, and this comes from Jesse Embry's oral history research. And the details here come through the descendants, the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren who were interviewed in the mid-20th century. So we're working through memory, which has its own distortions, but the broad outlines are well attested.
John Richardson is a farmer in rural Utah in the 1860s. He's not a church leader. He's not wealthy. He's just kind of your average Mormon. He marries a second wife in the early 1860s, and he enters the principle because he was told it was required for the highest degree of glory, and because there is this significant social pressure among men of his community to live the law if they could. His first wife, whose name in the oral record comes down as Sarah, had several children already. And the second wife comes into the household young.
How young? Brigham Young?
Well, this is one of those uncomfortable recurring facts in the historical record of plural marriage. Women entering these marriages in their teens is not uncommon. It's not universal, but it's definitely not rare. The second wife in the Richardson family accounts is described by descendants as being considerably younger than Sarah. And so what happens?
What happens is what happened in so many of these households. The resources didn't stretch. So John was farming marginal land. He built a second small home for the second wife, as was common, to give each wife her own domestic space, but it was barely habitable. Sarah's household saw a reduction in support John could provide. And so there were seasons where both families went without enough. Sarah, by the account of her grandchildren, passed down, never really recovered her sense of security. She survived, she raised her children, but the oral history account describes a woman who became withdrawn and quietly despairing in her later years.
Yeah, that's not a unique story. It's very much a quiet tragedy.
Quiet tragedy, I think, is a story of many women. It's the kind that doesn't make it into the grand historical narrative about plural marriage because nothing catastrophic happened. There was no apostasy, no legal case, no published memoir. Just a woman whose life was chipped away and diminished by a practice that she had been told was sacred, practiced by a man who was doing what his community and his faith told him to do. And the tragedy is how ordinary it was.
And our third story is going to be a little different in register, I would say.
Very different. Eliza R. Snow is one of the most important women in 19th century American religion, full stop. She is also unknown outside Mormon history. She was sealed to Joseph Smith as a plural wife in Nauvoo, and after Joseph's death, she was sealed to Brigham Young, which was the pattern for many of Joseph's widows, and she never has children on her own.
Quick publishing tangent here. There's a collection of her sermons that just got published that quasi-official by Church Historians Press. Like, this shows you the status that she has. And Jill Durr is still hard at work on a full, complete biography of her. This is a woman that people care about. So, but that's an interesting part of her life is she does not have children. For our listeners who are unfamiliar with the natures of Mormonism, not having children for a woman, that's a pretty significant thing in a culture that really valorizes motherhood as your eternal destiny.
And yet, Eliza R. Snow becomes, through the 1860s and beyond, the most powerful woman in the institutional church. She serves as president of the Relief Society, the women's organization, for decades. She actually writes and influences theology. She writes hymns. She is called Zion's poetess. And she is unambiguous, articulate, and a fierce defender of plural marriage, the handmaiden of the patriarchal order of the time.
Why?
Because for her, it was the architecture of her entire spiritual life. Her sealing to Joseph Smith was the defining relationship of her existence. Even though Joseph was dead, even though she was then sealed to Brigham, even though she never had children, she believes that the principle was divine, and she wrote about it in the terms of women's elevation, not women's subjugation. She argued that plural marriage freed women from dependence on a single man by embedding them in a covenant community. And that's not how we'd frame it today, but it was a coherent feminist theology on its own terms in her mind, and she relentlessly used her ideas and platform to move other Mormon women into compliance.
Even though she was one of dozens of wives, Eliza R. Snow's voice, her institutional power, her theological confidence is real and documented. Like Lindsay said, she used it often to pressure other women into plural marriages. And just a quick tangent, women in plural marriages who probably would have children that they would have to take care of, including sometimes the other wife's children, and would have to do a lot of domestic labor that I'm quite confident saying that Eliza didn't have to do. Her plural marriage looked significantly different than others. In the course of her Relief Society work, she visited tons of wards, primaries, Relief Societies, young women's, giving talks along the way, telling women that resistance to the principle was spiritual weakness. So she's simultaneously a genuine example of a woman who found meaning and power and purpose inside this institution and was an instrument of the institution's coercive pressure on other women.
Yeah, I think she's both things. And I think she's one of the most important people to understand if you want to understand why polygamy persisted as long as it did, because it's not just men enforcing this. Some of the most effective enforcers of the practice were women who believed in it. And that's historically uncomfortable. I don't like it, but it's also true.
And Eliza, it would be difficult for central casting to get you a better character for this because she's cultured, she's refined, she's a writer, she's seen as kind of this leading intellect. Well, if she thinks this is great and righteous, then why shouldn't you? She's a very potent voice in this discussion. Now, let's talk about another thing. Let's talk about ages for a minute, because in Mormon studies, that's always a hot topic for debate. So in 1867, right in the middle of this decade we're talking about, James Blake, the Southern Utah mission historian, counted 69 of St. George's 172 husbands as polygamists, right about 40%. So there you go. There's a specific enumerated count from a specific named person in a specific year, which is a lot more potent than a census aggregate. Blake's an insider. He's meticulous. He adds three extra columns to the standard quarterly reporting form just to track plural husbands, wives, and children separately. Clearly, this is a guy who thought this was worth counting carefully.
Bennion also notes that polygamous marriages peaked during the Mormon Reformation of around 1856 to 57, 58, which means the marriages contracted at the peak were in full swing with young children, established households, the whole infrastructure of plural family life through the 1860s. So the decade isn't just statistically high, it's the decade when all those Reformation era marriages were also maturing. And when Brigham Young organized the Southern Utah Mission in October of 1861, back to the start of the decade, nearly 30% of the married men he sent were already polygamists. And Bennion's analysis shows that polygamists were significantly more likely to stay in the harsh conditions of Dixie than monogamous. The quote, backouts was a term of men who left and returned north, and they were disproportionately younger men with one wife. The people who persisted and built St. George were disproportionately plural families. So the physical settlement of Southern Utah in the 1860s was literally built by polygamous households as its primary labor force and social unit.
There's our theology of sacrifice coming to bear again.
People always say Southern Utah's different. I mean, there's a reason culturally.
Yes. If you can make it in St. George in the summer in 1864, you can make it just about anywhere.
Do you like pink eye? How about for four of your wives?
There's nothing like the gentle, nuanced flavors of dust on your tongue, like all the time. Yeah. And again, like if you have already been able to make polygamy work, you can, again, you can, oh no, it's hot. I've done polygamy. Trust me, I can do that.
Why aren't we sending more Mormon polygamists to colonize Mars? That's all I'm trying to say. They're already prepped for it. They can make refried beans into anything, and they can live communally better than billionaires. I promise you that.
I mean, if the CIA will target Mormons, like, why doesn't NASA? Seems like a fairly natural
outgrowth. We're telling you, million-dollar idea here.
So, yeah, so we get Davis Bitten was citing Stanley Ivens on this. It's one of the more interesting pieces of evidence in all these documents because Ivens found that polygamy didn't sustain itself naturally, that it required external pressure and internal revival periodically to maintain enthusiasm. He writes the quote, "It always took some form of pressure to stir them to renewed zeal. Left alone, they were prone to neglect it." I mean, I think you can fairly easily see why this works out. The 1860s sit right at the intersection of these two pressures. Like we mentioned, you've got the Morrill Act in 1861 that is a real, if not enforced, external legal threat, and the afterglow of the Mormon Reformation that's created this internal spiritual intensity. They're both going on at the same time. That combination, outside threat plus internal revival, is precisely the conditions that Ivens identified as producing polygamy's peaks. The 1860s has both of them at once in a way that no other decade did quite the same way.
D. Michael Quinn's research cited by Bitten found something striking about the church leadership specifically. Quote, "Between 1852 and 1890, it's clear that if one was not a polygamist at the time of being elevated to the hierarchy, he almost inevitably soon succumbed to the pressure to take plural wives. George Q. Cannon's ordination as an apostle in August of 1860 is a direct example of this dynamic in action at the very start of the decade. Men ascending to power in the 1860s were entering an institution where plural marriage was effectively a prerequisite for advancement."
A demographic study by Smith and Coons that Davis Bitten cites found something counterintuitive about the 1860 census specifically. The overall male to female ratio in Utah in 1860 is almost 101 to 100, essentially equal. But that aggregate masks the age-specific picture. There was a large number of females aged from 20 to 29, relative to males aged from 30 to 39, which is exactly the demographic pairing that made polygamy structurally possible. Older men with resources that would then marry slightly younger women. The 1860 age structure was, in other words, almost perfectly configured for maximum polygamy. By 1880, the ratio had shifted to 107 men per 100 women, which makes that math even harder.
Are your nerd hats on? Because this is math class, and we always do our equations doing polygamy math. And we'll use Burton's visit in 1860 as a story problem because it functions as independent corroboration of the peak. He's not citing census data. He's walking the streets, he's visiting households, he's attending conference, mingling with the people, if you will, and what he observes matches the statistical picture. A community where plural marriage is so normalized that Artemisia Snow's comment from 1878 resonates, quote, "It looks very odd to me nowadays to see a man living alone with one wife." And Burton saw the same thing 18 years earlier.
The most underused piece of evidence is Blake's 1877 count showing that even after the decade ends, St. George's plural families composed 50% of the total population and 65% of married women were plural wives. That statistic is then the shadow that the 1860s cast forward. The decade built something that persisted. And then the Edmonds Act of 1882 started dismantling it. So the 1860s aren't just the peak, they're the decade that set the ceiling that everything afterward was measured against and slowly chipped away from. The single most powerful piece of evidence across all the documents is probably this combination. The 1860 census shows nearly 44% of the population in polygamous households. Blake's 1867 count shows 40% of St. George husbands were polygamous. The age structure of the 1860 population was optimally configured for the practice. The Reformation marriages were still young and active. The Morrill Act had just exactly created the kind of external pressure Ivens identified as sustaining zeal. And Richard Burton walked through the middle of it all and saw a community where plural marriage was simply the unremarkable texture of everyday life. Every piece of evidence points the same direction.
Okay, so let's try and simplify that.
No, Lindsay, in polygamy math class, there's no simplifying.
What would you call simplifying? Excommunication? I don't know. Bunyan's St. George mapping work contains the most useful demographic framing on age. He notes that in the polygamous households he mapped, quote, the latest wife was at least 10 to 20 years younger than the first. And he identifies this as the consistent trend across the data, not an outlier. He also specifically flags, quote, the importance of the teenage female population in making the high prevalence of Mormon polygamy possible. Hate that sentence. That's a direct statement from the sources that teenagers were structurally essential to the practice at its peak. And he cites Bitten and Lamson's demographic work to support this. And the St. George appendix in Bunyan's article also has a woman named Martha Cragen, who becomes Isaiah Cox's third wife, and the 18 census lists her age as 18, with Cox at 31. That's one documented case in the data with specific ages attached.
Smith and Coons' fertility study, cited by Davis Bitten, notes that, quote, the large number of females aged from 20 to 29 relative to males aged from 30 to 39 would permit a significant amount of polygyny among these males. So the demographic pairing the research identified as structurally enabling polygamy was specifically older men and younger women in that 20 to 29 age bracket.
Okay, I want to talk about presentism because I'm developing a feature film that adapted Judith Freeman's Redwater, which is the historical fiction of John D. Lee's Plural Wives after the massacre. And I'm excited that this will become a movie because if you know me, I've talked about this book. It's meant the world to me. So it's an honor to adapt it with my co-writer Mandy Cogman and her husband Brian, who, by the way, wrote Game of Thrones and who's producing it. And so I had to dive back into this research when we were working on this. And I remember reading about John D. Lee marrying Anne Gore. And Anne remarking that everyone around her thought it was gross that Lee was marrying such a young girl. Now, Anne claims at one point that she's like 13 when she marries him, but the dates are murky and place her as old as 17. Anyway, she's young. She's young and she's younger than most. And I think about this all the time when people tell me, well, that's just what they did back then. People married younger wives, meaning that in the 19th century, it was totally normal to marry teenagers. And it's just not true.
It is occasionally true, but that case is when the dude is also a teenager.
For sure, for sure.
I think, like, that's people forget, like, no, like my great-great-grandma was 17. It's like, yeah, and your great-great-grandpa was also 17.
And
he wasn't 40.
Just because it exists in society, like horrible gorilla behavior, primate behavior exists in human beings, it doesn't mean that you want to do that. And Anne's story is a perfect example of, like, people thought it was wrong then. And the only difference is it's just easier to get away with in the 19th century because you don't have laws. You have a lot of, you know, you have a young developing country. People still criticized it all the damn time. Twin relics of barbarism, anyone?
The Snow article on British travelers notes that several of them were specifically worried about, quote, the early age at which Latter-day Saint females married. This is one of the named concerns about the practice, alongside legal status and some other objections. Joseph Ollivant raised it specifically. So outside observers in the 1860s and 70s were noting young marriage age as a visible and troubling feature of what they're seeing.
Embry's oral history work mentions Vady Henderson as a young woman brought into the Hart household under circumstances that she didn't fully understand, and describes her as considerably younger than Ada. And the Richardson family account describes Becky Jacobson, quote, as a young Danish immigrant. And this language of youth, this, like, young convert and young woman and newly arrived, recurs in descriptions of plural wives throughout the Embry material, but precise ages aren't always given.
So Catherine Danes, who's also done a lot of really good demographic work, studied Manti in Utah across three cohorts and found the following for the frontier period, finding that the median marriage age for women is just under 19 years, where the mean of men is just over 20 years. But that mean is substantially inflated by immigrants who arrived as adults, women who already had grown up in Utah and arrive in Utah in their late 20s. So if you bracket out those immigrants, you're looking only at Utahns, women who are born in Utah, who arrived before age 14, the mean drops significantly. So Utah-born women married at a mean of roughly 18 years old during the frontier period, with the immigrants pulling that overall average all the way up to 20.
I'd love to see that same data in the early 2000s when I was married, because most girls were considered an old maid at 22 if they weren't married.
And the percentage at age data that they present is even more striking. So by age 16, 27% of frontier period women in Manti are already married. 16. By age 20, 83% had married. By age 24, a mere 3% are still single. So that's a marriage market operating at extraordinary efficiency and at very young ages by any standards. And yes, that's including the standards of the 1860s. So for comparison, Danes notes that women in Massachusetts in 1860 married at a mean age of just under 24 years. Women in Western rural areas nationally married at a mean of slightly over 20 years. So Mormon women in Utah married younger than both those groups and considerably younger than the national norm of the era. Larry Logue's St. George data, cited in the Davis Bitten Val Lamson article, found women married at a mean age of just about 19 years from 1861 to 1880. That's the most mathematically rigorous source in all of this stuff, and its findings on age are important. So the entire model for why polygamy is demographically sustainable rests on this one core mechanism: women married substantially younger than men. The model shows that a 5-year age gap between men's and women's marriage ages generates roughly 116 marriageable women for every 100 marriageable men. That surplus right there, that 16-person difference, that surplus is what makes polygamy mathematically possible at all. Then a 10-year gap generates even higher ratios. The table in their article showed that the implied age difference for Mormon polygamy rates runs between 5 and 12 years, depending on the specific estimate that was used.
Okay, so let's put that in story form again. So Joseph Smith married, what, 10 teenage wives, the youngest being Helen Marr Kimball and Nancy Winchester at age 14. And the
What was that age again?
Almost shy.
Oh, yes. Yeah, okay. That's better. That's better.
We got to be precise in our math. The apologetic argument is that this was culturally normal. I had a man tell me the other day, well, that's just when women menstruated. It's like, gross. Okay, not that women menstruate. The men think that that's an acceptable argument for polygamy. So the counter evidence to, you know, that's just culturally normal is that in Massachusetts at the time, the average female marriage was around 22 to 24 years old. Only 3-4% of women married in their teens at all, just like now, usually for special circumstances, teens running away, teens getting pregnant, those kind of things. And roughly 0.04% married at 14 or 15. The honest synthesis is this: Utah Mormon women married younger than American women generally and younger than the national frontier age too. And there's a reason for it. The median of 18 to 19 age in Manti and St. George is real. Polygamy demanded it. Brian just talked about the gap. This is what it means. If most men married to women of their own age, the population of males to females in nature is split about 50-50. This happens to men and women. And if everyone gets married because it's required, 50-50, you run out of women your own age to marry and as plural wives. So if you need extra wives, same thing happened in the modern LDS, that the harder Warren Jeffs enforced polygamy, the younger the wives got because you literally run out of women.
So remember that statistic from earlier. By age 16, more than a quarter of frontier period Utah women in Manti had already married. The entire demographic architecture of polygamy depended on women marrying 5 to 10 years younger than men. That's just numbers. That age gap is what creates the surplus of marriageable women that makes the math of plural marriage possible at all. Without young brides, the system collapses, by simple math. You just can't do it. At the very top of the institution, Joseph Smith had married women as young as 14. Brigham Young instructing plural wives they shouldn't be sexually approached until they were at least 18, which is an acknowledgement by itself that girls younger than 18 were entering those marriages. All right, kids, great work. Math class is adjourned for the evening. So, this decade of the 1860s, What's our takeaway from this?
I think what I take away is this, that the 1860s are the decade when plural marriage was most fully itself. If you want to understand it, understand this time. It's the most publicly practiced, the most demographically present, the most theologically defended. And what that means is that all the tensions that would eventually tear it apart, especially the legal pressure from the federal government, the material hardship on ordinary families, the women who couldn't reconcile the promise with reality, the coercion that lived inside the consent of those who were already present in the 1860s, the height was also the beginning of the unraveling of it. And the people who lived it were real people making real choices inside a system that was much bigger than any of them.
I think that's the thing that we want listeners to hold. Not a caricature, but these real people. Sarah Richardson going quiet in her later years, Eliza R. Snow writing her hymns, preaching sermons to everyone she could find, Anna Eliza Young deciding she's had enough, all those handcart pioneers arriving in Salt Lake City in September of 1860, pulling their carts into a community where nearly half the households had more than one wife. These are all real people. They're navigating something genuinely unprecedented, and they're paying real costs at times. I've seen no sign of you. I only heard of you. Hugging up the big Books of Mormon's report. Powered by Benchmark Books. On the book front, we would suggest Catherine Dane's More Wives Than One, Transformation of the Mormon Marriage System, 1840 to 1910. This one's important because, like we talked about, it takes demographic data to make claims, not vibe claims. This is possible because she focused on specific communities. On a similar note, a whole issue of BYU Studies was devoted to looking at St. George to see what kind of hard data conclusions they could draw. Articles by Catherine Dane's, Ben Benyon, Davis Bitten, and Val Lamson are very helpful in their specificness. As always, you can get these and everything else in the Mormon universe at Benchmark Books. Visit Benchmark in Salt Lake or at benchmarkbooks.com.
Offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I sinned so gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.